Patrick Phelps is this week's after-dinner speaker. He lives in the big city of, well, I don't know if he does live in the big city of Greymouth or Hokitika. He used to live in a big city in China. That's when he first started speaking to Patrick, when he was our correspondent from there. These days, he's an advocate for the mining sector. He's from Minerals West Coast. Kia ora, Patrick. Welcome back to Nights.
Oh, kia ora. Evening, Brian. Just in case you're curious, living in the big smoke of Hokitika now.
The metropolis of Hoki.
Yep, that's the one.
Right, now, to set the scene for tonight's discussion, here's a soundbite from this man recorded earlier.
Our country has squandered the last 30 years. It would have been a lot easier for us if we'd actually started reducing emissions 30 years ago. And the fact is that, you know, we are one of the highest emitting countries in the world on a per capita basis. And what that means is that we're now in a situation where, having, you know, essentially fluffed around for three decades, the cuts that we need to make over the coming decade are far steeper than they would have been if we could.
And that's a little bit of Corin Dan jumping in there at the end, because that was from Morning Report. That was a climate change minister and Green Party co-leader James Shaw. Patrick, why does a mining advocate want to start a discussion on RNZ National Nights with a clip from a Green Party co-leader?
Well, the things that James Shaw said are technically true, but only if you omit a lot of other variables. And yes, New Zealand's emissions have continued to climb over the last 30 years, but I wouldn't consider that we have squandered the past 30 years in that respect. I mean, there are a few reasons for which New Zealand is a massive outlier in the world, particularly in the developed world. And one of those is that we have had to contend with about a 50% or just shy of a 50% increase in our population over the last three decades, which hasn't been the case for most other developed countries, certainly not the European Union, which from memory, the population's only gone up about 6%. And for even the United Kingdom, the population's only gone up about 16%. So that's
And Patrick, how have we housed that extra 50% of people?
Well, I suppose we've rolled a lot of steel and concrete and built quite a few houses, I guess.
Yeah, I suppose that's a dumb question. The point I'm making, Patrick, is the way we've chosen to do that and why it's had such a dramatic effect on our emissions. We've chosen to do that with motorways and sprawl. That's where they've gone. They've gone to the massive suburbs of Auckland and in parts of Wellington and Christchurch, which costs fossil fuels. We've chosen to do that. So in that sense, James Shaw is damn right.
Well, yes, but how else do you actually develop a country? You know, I mean, we have only got a population of 5 million people spread out.
So, James, sorry, Patrick. So, we've had an increase in population.
For James Shaw, but carry on.
We've had an increase in population, which makes public transport more economic. Yet we've done the opposite. We've chosen to do the opposite. That's why he's right to say we've squandered an opportunity. We could have had policies in place. What we've done in the last 40 years is encourage motor transport. And now we're sitting around waiting for electric cars to save the day.
To an extent. But, I mean, yeah, we have chosen to do that. But I wouldn't say that we've squandered. I mean, public transport in this country, to my mind, has never been economic. It's going back a fair way, but my great-grandfather was a truck driver, and he used to, as a truck owner, had to pay a levy to whatever the predecessor of KiwiRail was, I guess NZ Rail must have been the name back in the day, for every mile that truck ran against rail, because rail was just that uneconomic. And even in the last, I can't remember exactly when the report came out, but the Tahuia line from Hamilton up to Auckland, yes, it's been heavily publicly subsidised, but it's actually performing in such a way that because so few people are choosing to use it, and you have to take into account there are a lot of individual choices at play, because of the very low patronage, because of very few people choosing to use it, it's actually got a higher per person emissions, even if the people who are driving a diesel car is just one person per car going between Hamilton and Auckland, and a far higher cost once you factor in the subsidy. So
yeah, Patrick, of course, why would you bother with Tahuia when you've got this massive road network that's been built between Auckland and Hamilton? Of course you're going to choose the car option. It's so easy. But that's a sub. We have chosen to subsidise that lifestyle. that sprawling lifestyle. That's been our choice. We voted for it, but now we're paying for it in higher emissions, aren't we? Because as you are going to point out, it's transport that's been the biggest contributor to our increase, isn't it? Transport and us going dairy, am I right?
No, not necessarily going dairy, actually, because the methane emissions have actually been relatively flat and they've fallen on a per capita basis. So and part of the saving grace there has been that the reason that we've had room for more dairy cows is because we've had fewer sheep farms. So as sheep numbers have fallen, dairy cattle have increased, but the overall increase in methane emissions hasn't been drastic. You know, in the context of a nigh on 50% population growth, it's only been about a 6% growth in agricultural methane emissions. But regarding vehicles, I mean, what we could do now is, rather than continuing with government subsidies that have been proven failure in the past, would be to have an effective emissions trading scheme. And I know you're going to say to me that we're pushing to keep it low, but the problem is we've still got to stay competitive internationally. I mean, I was just down at the supermarket and, you know, not infrequently I see Danish and French butter there. So clearly, whether it's because they're subsidised at home or whatever, you know, we still want our meat and dairy to be competitive internationally. And we, just to put it in context, in terms of the price that New Zealand puts on its emissions, there are only about one-fifth of global emissions that are captured by some form of a carbon tax or an emissions trading scheme. So in New Zealand, we've got an emissions trading scheme. And even within that fifth, you know, not considering the 80% that aren't priced at all, even within that fifth that are priced, the average price internationally is about $3 US a tonne. For New Zealand, it works out to about $50 US a tonne. So we've already got an ETS price 17 times above the international average. And internationally, I guess we should be pushing for other countries to adopt emissions trading schemes, but we can't absolutely kneecap our own productive sector in the process. And, you know, maybe the answer is electric cars, maybe the answer is more rail. But even at the moment, it's only taken a war in the Ukraine to get the government to reduce the excise tax because it hasn't been politically feasible over the past 30 years allow petrol prices to go.
That's right. I mean, it hasn't been politically to say, right, okay,
and even now,
car drivers.
I'd argue even now it's not politically feasible.
No, I agree with you. Absolutely. And is this why you, as a mining advocate, is this why you're worried? Because you're worried, Patrick, aren't you, that mining is going to be the sacrificial lamb, that it's politically easier for a government, maybe even a national-led government, to shut down mining on the West Coast than it would be to say to people who drive cars, and most people in New Zealand do, you've got to pay the full price, environmental price, or buy electric, or to shut down dairying to reduce methane emissions. It's going to be easier to shut down mining, isn't it?
Well, I would hazard a guess that most New Zealanders have far more recently pumped petrol than they have shoveled coal. You know, so it's a lot more visible to most people, the pain at the pump when the price of petrol goes up. But, I think that is the direction it's heading in. I mean, the Labor government at the last election, or the Labor Party in the lead up to the last election, a lot of their policies centred around getting rid of coal boilers, even though the emissions growth from that technology has been effectively flat over the last 30 years and overall even today. It's a small portion of our carbon footprint. And I was looking through the Green Party climate change policy today and yesterday, and most of it mentions, the energy and the electricity sector, and there's really little to say as far as transport goes. So, yeah, that does seem to be the more politically expedient thing to do. But what's politically profitable and what's necessarily right or just are quite often two very different things. So I think the best thing that we could do is to have a functional emissions trading scheme. But again, we've got to be very, very aware of where we sit, given that we export our goods internationally and we compete against imports domestically.
That's where I want to ask you. So, Patrick, you want a functional, what you call a functional emissions trading scheme. Let's just remind listeners of what it is. It's basically a trading scheme is there's a cap on the amount of emissions and you buy a quota, right? You buy the right.
You pay per unit that you emit. So, for example, it depends on the coal because each coal's got its own properties. Every time you burn a ton of coal, you emit about 2-ish tons of CO2. And so you pay for that. So it's attached to the price in the same way it's attached, in the same way that GST is attached to anything you buy. And then that price theoretically filters through and, you know, that's then ends up in the tomatoes that you buy or the milk that you buy or the steel that you buy. And there are carve-outs and things for, trade-exposed sectors, but those are being peeled back. And if we do peel them back too quickly, then the precise thing that's going to happen is that our goods will be less competitive against other goods produced offshore that don't have a price. So it's very finicky because we're in a global climate and we're also in a global economy. But the other thing that I think would be beneficial, and I've sort of come to this conclusion over the last few months, is that it's not that the government doesn't do enough to help renewable development. It actually does quite a lot to hinder it. I mean, if you read through a lot of comments from experts or industry associations in terms of wind energy or geothermal or even, you know, hydro, the Resource Management Act, and from what people make of the potential Natural Built Environments Act, those are all going to be, well, they do already inhibit renewable development, and the NBA is very likely to as well, based on what those organisations have seen of it so far anyway.
In what way, Patrick?
Well, you know, if you want to stick a windmill up behind someone's house, you've kind of got to ask them first, you know, and if you want to, you know, put in a geothermal scheme, there's going to be groundwater effects and all that sort of stuff. But if we want to have more renewable development, well, how much of a barrier do you want in place? So this starts to get very thorny in terms of property rights, in terms of other environmental trade-offs. You know, if you've got wind turbines and bird paths, if you've got hydro schemes on sensitive rivers, if you've got issues with groundwater as far as geothermal take and all that sort of stuff goes, it's very complicated. But in the context of trying to reduce our reliance on fossil fuels, well, how much do you want to inhibit those other technologies being developed?
So, Patrick, getting back to a functional, in your words, functional emissions trading scheme, you've also pointed out that you don't want an ETS, short for emissions trading scheme, that hobbles our own export industry. So, but if you don't have something that has, if you don't put a real value on the price of emitting carbon, people will continue to emit it.
Well, yes, they will, but that's also true if you put too much of a price on it. It actually becomes cheaper just to do the emissions elsewhere, but it still ends up in the international climate.
What, overseas? So we just export our pollution to?
Effectively, yeah, and you also export, well, you know, you lose your income and you lose jobs and things like that as well. I mean, you know, you mentioned at the start that, you know, I used to live in China. I mean, we think very highly of our animal proteins here and, you know, with our Edmund Hillary complex, think that we lead the world and so on. But when you see a slab of steak in a chiller in Shanghai or a block of butter in a supermarket in Nanjing, it is right beside Irish butter and Australian butter and Chinese butter, and the majority of consumers are driven by price. And so if we put our price up too much, then we won't be able to compete. And the other flip side of that is that it's fairly well established that New Zealand's meat and dairy products have got the lowest impact in terms of the climate impact in the world. So insofar as you've still got billions of people around the world...
Well,
still
apart from the methane that comes out of the cows and the cost of diesel emissions and getting it to the market overseas.
Even once all of those things are factored in, I mean, I know this from when I worked at Silverfin Farms because Ag Research did some study on it as well, is that even when you've got a kilogram of cooked lamb on someone's plate in the UK, that still has a lower impact on the climate than if it's been produced in England or Wales, because the majority of the emissions occur before the animal even leaves the farm to go to the freezing works, because most of it's to do with the methane emissions. And while methane emissions are high, they are lower in New Zealand than any other country in the world because of our pasture-based farming system and the fact that the animals harvest their own food.
Well, the other thing is we just have to use our land for different uses, and we need to farm things that don't produce methane. We need to go soy.
Well, potentially so, but that's where you have a pricing mechanism. Now, I know that farmers are against methane being brought into the emissions trading scheme, and I would be hesitant for New Zealand to be the first country in the world to do that. The other difficult thing with bringing agriculture into the ETS, as far as I'm aware, is that it's much harder to measure than emissions coming out of chimneys or exhaust pipes or things like that. So it's a thorny issue, but I think it's disingenuous to suggest that New Zealand has squandered the last 30 years, because we have actually had to increase our energy supply by about 60% to keep up with the demand of our population. Our carbon dioxide emissions have stayed about the same per capita, because even though there's been an increase in oil use per capita, that's been offset by a reduction in natural gas and coal consumption. And our rate of renewables in our mix has actually increased. So, except in transport, yeah, because there's nowhere in the world, even in Norway, where they have subsidised electric vehicles up the wazoo, they've still got higher carbon dioxide emissions per capita than what New Zealand does. Only a fraction higher, but they are still higher. But we've gone from 33% renewable energy in our total supply, that's not just electricity, that's across the entire energy mix, up to about 40.5%. And a lot of that's been done by geothermal and to a much smaller extent wind.
Patrick, sorry to interrupt, but the other thing I want to bring up, because we're running short of time, is that The other thing about an emissions trading scheme is the effect it might have on hill country farming, in that people both here and overseas will buy our land to plant pines to soak up carbon. And that is already an issue for some parts of rural New Zealand, isn't it, Patrick? Maybe not so much in the coast, because they don't grow pines so much there.
Well, there's not a lot of steep country to farm it on. It's still covered in that bush, quite pleasantly, right. holding quite a lot of carbon compared to the rest of the country. But yeah, no, you're right. And the obvious answer for that, to my mind anyway, would be to have biodiversity credits that, alongside carbon credits, would incentivize the planting of native bush as opposed to pine forestry. But yeah, that is an issue as well. I mean, even on the flip side of it, gold miners are actually struggling with that now too, because quite a good land supply for gold miners has been that as pine is harvested, you can get in there and mine it. But the incentive now is to replant it so quickly that it's actually quite difficult to work the ground out before you replant it. So no, that is becoming an issue. But again, it's complicated. The problem is, as soon as you put these prices in place, it gets very tricky, especially when you've got the government meddling with other, you know, boiler bans or ute levies or subsidies for Teslas and things like that.
Which is all just easy politically. Easier. And Patrick, now you make a valid point about the fact that we could just end up exporting polluting industries overseas. And mining could be one of those. And some of the mining, the coal, that one, the biggest source of revenue for the West Coast, tell me if I'm wrong, is the coal that goes to steel mills overseas. Would that be correct?
Well, that would be out of the buller. I mean, one of the biggest sources of revenue for the West Coast is actually from our dairy exports. But
okay, but we're talking about mining.
I mean, yeah, but we effectively export our coal as milk powder. We add value to it by turning it into milk powder.
I see what you mean.
It sends overseas. Go on.
But it's still that mining for steel is important. And it's going to be a while before we produce steel without using coal. And we're still going to need steel to build ourselves out of this problem that we've got, whatever way we might do it. So what does mining have to do you think, Patrick, to be seen as part of a solution and not part of a problem? Because I do think you're out on the limb, almost literally here in New Zealand, mining on the West Coast.
I'll accept that it's not the flavour of the month, not by any stretch. It hasn't been the entire time I've been doing this job. I mean, if it does become so, I'll put myself out of work, I guess. But I think the main thing that the mining industry's got to do is probably, there's the consumption side of it when the emissions go up into the atmosphere, but there isn't an alternative for steel and for coal and steel making. And a lot of people talk up hydrogen. There's about 99% of the world's hydrogen comes from fossil fuels at the moment. It's going to be a long time until that changes. So regarding the extraction of coal for steel production in the Asia Pacific, I think if we're going to continue to mine on the West Coast, it has to be done in a way where, and a lot of those coal reserves are on conservation land, and that's a thorny issue that we've discussed before. It's got to involve world-class restoration and compensation for predator control to ensure that there is, and this can be calculated by ecologists from the Department of Conservation and things like that, to ensure that there is a net gain for the conservation estate. So you quantify the biodiversity outcomes and ensure that the conservation estate is actually better off as a result of mining. And to my mind, if you can get into that territory, and I believe it's achievable because of the amount of wealth that mining generates, then I think there's actually an opportunity cost in not mining, because we're desperate for funding for pest control. So, yeah.
Now, Patrick, just going back to something you pointed out, the point you made earlier, do you really think that public transport is always uneconomic? For example, that coal, again, that we were talking about, that goes to steel mills, how does it get from the mine to the port?
Oh, it goes by rail, yeah.
Because and do you think rail is, they're not losing money doing that? They're not doing that as a do-gooder service for you, are they?
Oh, no, from what I hear of people in the coal industry, KiwiRail is notorious to deal with, but that is one of the only sectors that's actually keeping the main trunk line open. A couple of scenic rides over the Alps on the Transalpine a week would not keep the West Coast to Christchurch link running. So in those instances, yes, it is economic, but I don't think there is an argument for government subsidies. I mean, I was impressed by the train network when I went to China. They are having massive trouble paying for that now because they borrowed so much money to get it up and running, and they haven't.
But it's all right to subsidise private transport and road transport with massive roads of national significance, but not upgrade our rail network, Patrick. I don't understand.
No, we don't subsidise it. We pay for it through our road user levies, which fantastically the government cut last week because people were grizzling about the price of petrol. And if you wanted to reduce fuel consumption, you would just let the price of petrol go up. So, you know, I think it's just having whatever road user charges you need, and then insofar as you can quantify the user pays benefit for rail, as people do per tonne of coal shifted, that's how you fund the railways, and that's how you would fund any city rail links. But until it's as convenient or more convenient or cheaper than just getting in your car and driving, people will continue to choose to get into their cars.
Are you seriously saying that road user charges pay for all those motorways we've built? They don't. That's government money. That's investment money that could have been invested in other modes of transport.
And insofar as they don't, you can put those road user charges up. We can haggle about the price, but nonetheless, I think that's the best way to fund the roading network. And per levy, you know, per ton of whatever goods are shifted per person that gets onto a passenger train, that is how you pay for a rail network, not by bankrolling. Government could make loans available, it could facilitate debt, but I don't. Like, you've got a ridiculous situation at the moment with Tahuia where you've got passengers paying $12 a ticket, and I read in the paper the other day something like $240 of subsidies. I mean, that is not going to work in the long run. If people think that's saving them money, they're fooling themselves, because it's coming out of your pockets in your taxes or your rates or one way or another. The best way to do it is to let the ETS do its job, and, you know, adjusting for those international inconsistencies, obviously, and to probably not come to the rescue every time the price of petrol or diesel goes up.
Patrick, thanks so much for joining us again. Are you there, Patrick?
Yes. Oh, thank you, Brian. I thought I heard the phone click.
I wouldn't hang up on you, Patrick. No, I wouldn't hang up on you. It's just that we've run out of time. We've got to move to the next program.
No, you must have bumped the microphone or something. No, thank you very much,
Brian. No, I've been bumping it before.
For Andrew's voice.
Anyway, lovely to have you on, Patrick.
Likewise, Brian. Cheers. See ya.
That's Patrick Phelps from Minerals West Coast.